From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Swedish voters speak, and now the rest of Europe has to try to figure out what they said. And meanwhile, news of a tweet that almost started a war on the Korean Peninsula, which raises the interesting question of what is happening on the Korean Peninsula these days. This is the Wall Street Journal editorial page's Foreign Edition podcast. I am Joseph Sternberg, filling in for Mary Kissel, who is on leave at a secure, undisclosed location at the moment. But I am joined here by my colleague and friend in Asia, also at a secure, undisclosed location, Hugo Restall. Hi, Hugo.
Hi, Joe. It seems to be spreading.
Well, hopefully your location will stay secure and undisclosed long enough for us to have a conversation for the next 20 minutes or so about the latest in global mayhem and disorder, the running theme of this podcast for several years now, as we try to make sense of yet another electoral domino to fall here in Europe. And so I thought that it might be good, since this is in the news after yesterday's election in Sweden, to take a look at what has been happening in that Nordic country, long considered a beacon of tolerance, which has become the latest European country, not necessarily to lurch to the far right, despite many of the headlines that you see, but rather, I think the storyline here is just the extent to which voters in Sweden, as in so many other places, have lost faith in mainstream political parties. And as a result of that, we seem to have much more confused politics. I think it's a little difficult to say that it is lurching to the right. It's more a matter that it is just becoming a muddle. And I think that you see that if you look at some of these results that we've had. The Social Democrats, long the top vote getter, coming in with about a 28% vote share, which is the lowest they have ever won. The Swedish Moderates, which are the main center-right party, also the big losers yesterday, down 3 or 4 percentage points to about 20%. The main center-right and center-left alliances in Swedish politics, both at about 20%, 40%. Either side of that divide is going to struggle to form a governing coalition now. And meanwhile, you have this upsurge of the Sweden Democrats, a party with some very troubling origins, who claim that they have purged their nationalist neo-Nazi elements and gone legit, winning almost 18% of the vote, playing the spoiler here. I think that looking at this, looking at results that we've had in elections in Germany, in the Netherlands, even in France, it is remarkable, this collapse of centrist parties and especially center-left parties that we are seeing all across Europe.
Right. I mean, it's remarkable that the backlash wasn't even greater, right? I mean, there were some polls that were suggesting that the Democrats were going to win more than 20% of the vote. So you could say that the results are an affirmation that Sweden's voters are not somehow lurching in a radical direction. But it does send enough of a message that they're dissatisfied with the leadership they've been getting. And a lot of it does seem to be focused on the immigration issue. I mean, Sweden has absorbed so many more refugees for its size than other countries, even in Europe. So, and they've seen some very troubling social consequences of that immigration. And so perhaps it's remarkable that Sweden has not had more of a reaction.
I think we can't talk about this election result without talking about the migration issue, which I think is something that's been hanging like a cloud over really every European election since 2015. Listeners will remember that the summer of 2015 is when Europe saw enormous numbers of migrants arriving primarily from the Middle East. You had a lot of people from Afghanistan, from war-torn Syria, Iraq. More recently, Europe has seen a lot of migrants from northern Africa, and even coming from as far away as sub-Saharan Africa. 2015 was the summer that Angela Merkel, Germany's center-right chancellor, gave her big "We Can Do It" speech, where she welcomed the migrants to come. Enormous controversy now as the European Union is trying to figure out how to process all of these people who are claiming asylum here in Europe, how to try to integrate them into the society, and also dealing with a bunch bunch of the law and order problems that arise from that. And what I found so interesting about the Sweden result, and this is something that we've been seeing in other parts of Europe, is yes, it's about that, but it also seems to be about more than that. Because one of the things that you really notice is that as we got closer to the election, there was less and less daylight between the Sweden Democrats, this more radical upstart party, less daylight between them on these migration issues and between them and the other parties, the mainstream center right moderates, the center left social democrats. And yet,
but how much of that is just those parties realizing which way the wind is blowing and desperately trying to get aligned with the voters ahead of the election? But, the Swedish voters know that in the past they've said things about fixing the immigration problem, but they've failed to do that.
Well, see, that is exactly what I think is going on here. I think that this is a lot bigger than migration. It's really about trust, because what we have started seeing again and again is that even when the mainstream parties try to adjust their positions to cater to a lot of these frustrations that voters clearly have on these issues, they are not persuading voters that they can be trusted to follow through on that. And I think that that almost is as big a problem in European politics right now as any of these concerns that all of the right-thinking, urban, educated voters and commentariat and political class, that category of people think that the problem here is that voters are just rebelling against being nice people, that the voters don't like the migrants in some way. I think that the bigger problem that you see here is that the voters just don't trust the politicians anymore.
But there is an element of the old Milton Friedman saying that you can have a welfare state or immigration, but not both. I mean, the influx of immigration has stretched housing, healthcare. There's a huge problem with unemployment among the refugees. So Sweden, although it isn't as socialist as Americans sometimes think it is, is not a dynamic enough economy to absorb such a large group of people in such a short amount of time, and that seems to have to really strain the welfare state in Sweden.
Well, and I think that that was a big aspect of this election campaign that a lot of commentators missed. I think we mentioned it in some of our editorials on this, was the issue of the welfare state and the campaigning that was related to that. And again, this is something that we've seen in a lot of other countries in Europe, too. I mean, these insurgent movements, we won't quite call them populist because that can be such a loaded word. They're often described as far-right movements, but actually that is often only true in terms of their attitude to cultural issues or immigration. On economics, they're often quite to the left, much right. More comfortable at the
voters,
socialist end.
Yeah, a lot of the voters that swing to them are blue-collar voters who have voted for the left-center parties in the past. I mean, very much like what we've seen in the U.S. with Trump, right?
Precisely. And that opens up this whole new interesting interaction between the migration issues and the welfare state. Because again, not very far under the surface in Sweden is this question of, well, we are accepting all of these migrants at a time when we were already having trouble delivering public services like public housing, public health care, and now we're straining the system with all of these new arrivals. I think that certainly in Germany, a point that I've heard from some people I speak to there is the sense that, well, Germany went through all of these painful welfare reforms 15 years ago, where we took away a lot of unemployment and other benefits to try to balance the government budget, get the economy going again. And now all of a sudden you have these newcomers coming in here trying to take advantage of this benefit system when we're still struggling to provide for ourselves. That, again, is, I think, an aspect of this European migration issue that people don't talk enough about. It isn't just about xenophobia or hostility to foreigners, although there might be elements of that. But I think it also ties into a lot of these much deeper and longer running economic problems in Europe.
I think you should also mention that there are some significant cultural issues here. I saw that Swedish national TV reported just before the election that 60% of the people convicted of rape and attempted rape are foreign-born, as compared to 17% of the overall population is foreign-born. And there's been a massive increase in sexual offenses just in the last 3 or 4 years. I think between 2013 and 2016, it was a 70% increase, which does raise the question of, you know, it is going to be quite difficult to assimilate people who have a very different attitude toward relations between the sexes, shall we say, into a Nordic population. You know, you have this court in March, I saw, has at least partially applied Sharia in acquitting a man of beating his wife because she had failed to try to resolve it within the family, which is what a good Muslim wife supposedly should do. So, you know, Swedes have some reason to be concerned, I think, that, you know, their culture, if not being under threat, is at least, you know, not being accepted by a lot of these new arrivals.
Right. And yeah, there are a couple aspects of that that I've been picking up on some of my own reporting on this issue over the past couple of years. I mean, first off, you do have a lot of these cultural clashes that tend to happen, for lack of a better word. But, you know, you also, and that tends to express itself in controversies over whether you know, Muslim immigrant women should be allowed to wear burqas or other head coverings. You know, certainly Denmark has been very aggressive in trying to ban that. You have you know, bans on headscarves in various contexts in France. But I think that the other thing that a lot of this exposes is also just the, you know, basic provision of public services problem that a lot of European countries have had you know, lingering for a long time. I mean, on the one hand, you know, some of these issues of sexual assault and other crimes are cultural issues, but on the other hand, you know, in the other sense, there is a law and order problem, and people are rightly asking, you know, whether their state has the capacity to enforce basic law and order on the streets of their cities. And we are
right.
talking
There's been a lot of burning of cars and riots in the last few years as well.
Precisely, and I think that if you're a voter in that kind of scenario, of course you're going to be frustrated and looking for some way that you can vent in an election. And we have been talking about Europe's latest electoral earthquake in Sweden. This is the Wall Street Journal's Foreign Edition.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Drive time, gym time, anytime. WSJ Podcasts.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I am Joseph Sternberg, filling in for Mary Kissel, who is on leave in a secure, undisclosed location. And I am here with my colleague, Hugo Restall, and we are going to go to Hugo's part of the world, Asia, now, to talk about North Korea. We have stunning revelations in Bob Woodward's latest book about the Trump administration. If anyone can remember that, that's a story from last week at this point. This news that at one point Trump almost sent a tweet that might have been construed by the North Koreans as a declaration of war before President Trump was talked out of it. But that raises this broader question of what is going on the Korean Peninsula right now. And I think that it's fair after a couple of months to ask, you know, Trump had his big summit with Kim Jong-un, the fearless dear leader of North Korea in Singapore a few months ago. A lot of heat over there. Not necessarily very much light about what they accomplished. And since then, I think that a lot of people are wondering, has the Trump method worked here? Are we actually accomplishing anything in North Korea right now?
Well, it's been a roller coaster ride, let's put it that way. A couple of weeks ago, Trump canceled a trip by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to Pyongyang, saying that there wasn't enough progress being made on denuclearization. But on Sunday, North Korea celebrated its 70th anniversary of the revolution and with a massive parade, as per usual. But the wrinkle this time was that the parade did not include any ballistic missiles. And that is being seen as a concession to the U.S. and South Korea, perhaps a gesture that they're ready to talk about arms control. And the parade emphasized instead economic development, which the young Kim, he's been doing a lot of trips around the country recently trying to talk up increased productivity and investment. So Trump has welcomed this as a sign that his diplomacy is working. I'm not convinced because, of course, what you put in a parade is a very cheap gesture. I mean, you can always bring the missiles back for the next parade. It doesn't fundamentally change anything, but it certainly improves the atmospherics, and perhaps we'll see a Pompeo trip and, another round of talks. But essentially, the North is demanding that the U.S. Make a concession and agree to make a declaration at the end of the Korean War before we proceed with denuclearization. And they're claiming that Trump made a promise to that effect at the Singapore summit. So it's not entirely clear that Trump meant to make a major concession, but perhaps he did in an offhand kind of way, and the North Koreans have signaled their intent to hold him to it.
I've been wondering for a while here, as the Trump administration was getting up and going, about whether there were actually maybe two tracks that were going on in terms of the U.S. approach to North Korea, the Trump track and then the everyone else in the administration track. So it seemed that on the one hand, while you had Trump himself making all of these fire and fury comments and then dialing that back and setting up this very his personal summit in Singapore with Kim Jong-un, you also had what seemed like a much more concerted, well-thought-out plan to try to bring some pressure to bear on the regime in terms of the economic sanctions. And I think that a fair question at this point might be, how are those two tracks interacting with each other at this point? I mean, is there any sign that Trump himself is now potentially prematurely trying to ease up on some of the pressure that the administration had actually been effectively applying before?
Well, we did ease up on the pressure. Essentially, from February to August, we did not designate, and the UN did not designate, any Chinese and Russian companies that were breaking the sanctions and did not put them on blacklists. So the sanctions really only work as long as you keep enforcing them, and the most important part of enforcing them is to catch people out who are breaking them. So we essentially suspended our enforcement of sanctions for those 6 months or so around the Singapore summit. And I guess you could say it's positive that in the last month we've started to enforce them again. But that was a very significant relaxation that allowed a lot of Chinese and Russian companies to import North Korean coal, which brings foreign exchange revenue to the North, which they can buy essentials both for their population and for their weapons programs. So that is not an encouraging picture. Even the South Koreans have been breaking sanctions. They imported some North Korean coal, albeit inadvertently, but the South Korean government did not go after the entities that were doing that importing either. So really, people have been breaking the sanctions with impunity.
Well, and that South Korean angle is something that I also wanted to pick up on, because that's been the other big moving part. I know you and I have talked a lot about, when we've done this podcast together in the past, because, again, in the sense of having multiple tracks going on in Korean diplomacy, under the Trump administration, you've then had like the Trump and the Trump administration tracks going on, but also the South Korean track that has been happening, because you have Moon Jae-in, who is certainly a much more left-leaning South Korean president who has come in and seems to be interested in pursuing a form of sunshine policy with the North. And yeah, I'm curious about how that dynamic has been playing out, particularly since the Trump summit. You know, are there signs that that kind of you know, South Korean, you know, diplomacy there, that kind of track is helping, or are there signs that they're starting to get in the way?
Well, I think it's definitely hurting. It's undermining the U.S. effort to, you know, to use carrot and stick. I mean, the South Korean approach is all carrot and no stick. And Trump has been blaming China for not helping with North Korea and not enforcing the sanctions as much as it should. But really, I think Kim Jong-un is getting more encouragement from South Korea than he is from China. Moon Jae-in has been essentially advocating for the North in pushing the Trump administration to give concessions such as peace declaration before denuclearization takes place. Moon wants to increase economic engagement between the two Koreas. He's even proposed that they should, together, they should form part of what he's calling an East Asian railroad community and connect up their railways and their roads so that trade can flow north from South Korea and then through to China. Moon Jae-in is also cutting the size of the South Korean military. He's made a proposal to cut the troop size, and he's dismantling guard towers along the demilitarized zone between the South and the North. So really a very what you say, peacenik kind of approach to North Korea, that if we can't we all just be friends, and if we shower the North Koreans with love, perhaps they'll see the light and disarm, which is, of course, horribly naive, has not worked in the past under previous South Korean presidents. The North has pocketed these benefits, and then as soon as the money or trade stops flowing, goes back to its usual saber rattling and development of nuclear weapons. So it is very concerning that our supposed ally in the South is undermining our North Korea policy and essentially trying to take over leadership of North Korea diplomacy so that we're unable to pursue the maximum pressure policy that the Trump administration started off with.
I think that leadership point is just so important here, and we'll have to close with this thought. But just this notion that a problem that America is really having right now is the inconsistent messages that come out of Washington so often on so many of these important strategic issues, and the difficulty that Washington creates both for allies and even for some leaders of allied countries where the individual leader might be more skeptical of the U.S. or U.S. power, the confusing messages that Washington sends out about what the Trump administration is wants its allies to do, and also just the sense of not knowing exactly what the plan is. I mean, this is certainly something that I would hope that some of President Trump's supporters are thinking about, because a big argument for him has always been that he would be very disruptive and unsettling to a status quo that, in so many ways hadn't been working before. But that does seem to be coming at the cost of greater uncertainty, about America's objectives and how Washington is hoping to achieve those. But I think that is enough global disorder for one day, so we will leave things there. Thanks to my colleague Hugo for joining today, and thanks to everyone for listening. Please subscribe to us wherever you get your audio content, and we will look forward to talking with you again later this week.